Good afternoon. Welcome to the Anderson Firm's 2019 Client Education Conference. Each year, we like to take this opportunity to share some information about a variety of topics that may affect you and your estate plan. Some of the information presented today will address recent or maybe potential upcoming changes in the law that may affect your plan, while other topics discuss additional planning techniques that might be beneficial to you or maybe just offer reminders about steps you need to take to maintain what you already have in place. This year's recording, as well as those from years past, can be found at www.theandersonfirm.com under the Resources tab, then click on Client Education. Now, to get us started, I'd like to introduce Jolene Searles. Jolene is the managing attorney for both our West Florida and Tennessee markets. In addition to her JD degree, she also holds an LLM in taxation, so that makes her the absolute perfect person to discuss our first topic, which is an update on the 2018 tax changes. Jolene, I turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Rhonda. As we all know, 2018 was the big year of tax changes, and we covered those on our call last year. So I don't want to be redundant, but if anyone's interested in hearing those changes again, we have our annual client education call from last year posted on our website, so you can find it there. Most of you saw the impact of these changes when you filed your taxes this year for 2018. Many of us may have seen less money being withheld from our paychecks this past year, but we also saw many changes as to how we did things in the past with regard to our taxes. I'm not going to talk about the changes for businesses, as Aaron will be covering that in just a bit, so I'm going to focus primarily on the individual changes and give you some updated numbers for 2019. These are the numbers that you'll use next year when you file your 2019 taxes. In 2018, we saw most of the federal tax rates and the income thresholds drop. The income thresholds were adjusted for inflation in 2019, although the tax rates stayed the same. So our 2019 standard deductions were adjusted for inflation, going up to $12,200 for a single person, $24,400 married filing jointly, and $18,350 for head of household. To give you an idea of the impact of the change in the standard deduction, prior to 2018, approximately 70% of people use the standard deduction. The projections going forward are that over 95% are going to be using it. The alternative minimum tax exemption and phase-out amounts were also adjusted for inflation, bumping that exemption up to $71,700 for single and head of household, and $111,700 for married filing jointly. And the phase-out income threshold to $510,300 for single person and $1,020,600 for married. The foreign earned income exclusion in 2019 was adjusted to $105,900. One thing that we saw change for the worse was in 2017 and 2018, you were able to deduct medical expenses if they exceeded 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. However, that bumps back up to 10% of AGI for 2019 and future years. As of 2019, the penalties for not having health coverage under the Affordable Care Act is repealed. However, remember there are several states like Massachusetts, New Jersey, Vermont, and some others that have passed their own health mandates or are planning to do so in the future. So please make sure that you're aware of any state-specific rules your state might have on that. We saw the deduction for alimony payments go away in 2019 for any divorces finalized or modified after 2018. So for people who already had their divorce agreements in place and have been deducting alimony, things won't change for you. But for anything going forward, you will no longer be able to deduct those alimony payments for any divorces finalized or modified after 2018. As we all know, the estate and gift tax exemption doubled from 5 million index for inflation to 10 million index for inflation. Our 2019 exemption is 11.4 million per person. As a reminder, this provision will sunset the end of 2025 and drop back down to 5 million index for inflation. There are also several other provisions that will sunset, so we'll need to stay tuned to see if Congress acts to extend any or all of these. Our annual exclusion amount stays at $15,000 per person. This is the amount that you can gift each year to as many people as you'd like without having to report it. So if I wanted to reward you all for calling in for our annual client education, I could write a check for $15,000 to each and every one of you without paying any taxes or having to report anything. But don't be looking in your mailboxes. We saw a lot of changes to state taxes. So check out our state tax chart on our website to see if your state was one of those states. With all the recent tax changes and especially the cap on the state and local tax deductions, we're seeing a mass exodus from high tax states like New York, New Jersey, Minnesota, California, and a couple others. But many of the people that are so-called leaving those states aren't actually leaving. They're simply changing their residency or claiming to do so, and the states have noticed. They're cracking down on these residency audits. If you've never been through a residency audit, this is definitely not something that you want to add to your bucket list. It's not a fun process, and most people do not emerge victorious from these. They're stepping up their game, and the states are known for checking phone records, pet boarding records, toll records, credit card statements, travel information, and even coming to your residence in that state to look in your refrigerator and dresser drawers. So they are getting really, really aggressive with these audits. So if you're changing your residency to a tax-friendly state like a Florida, make sure that you take all the appropriate steps in order to do so and don't cut any corners. It's so much more involved than just changing your driver's license and spending 6 months and a day out of that high-tax state. We've got a great checklist on our website of many of the things that you'll want to do, but we always encourage you to give us a call if this is something that you're considering. We're happy to talk through it with you. Obviously, if you're moving completely, it's a very easy feat to accomplish, but if you're planning on splitting your time between two states, it can be more difficult. It doesn't mean that splitting time makes a residency change impossible, it just means that we have a few more hurdles to jump through in order to do so. So if I haven't put all of you to sleep with this tax talk, I'm now going to turn it over to Aaron Turner, who's going to discuss some of the great tax breaks available for small businesses. Thanks.
Hi, this is Aaron, and today I want to spend a few minutes with you talking about a recent update to the tax code from the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, or TCJA for short, or also known as the Trump Tax Plan, which was that massive overhaul to the U.S. Tax code and new legislation that became effective January 1st of 2018. In particular, the section I want to focus on, it deals with a now up to 20% deduction for income that is derived from a pass-through business entity. And so the pass-through business entity is a term that's used for several different types of businesses, including S corporations and partnerships and sole proprietorships and the ever popular LLC. But before I go any further, I just want to remind everybody that the Anderson Firm doesn't give income tax planning advice or prepare tax returns. That's the CPA's role. However, we do form and help our clients maintain those types of pass-throughs entities I just mentioned as part of our clients' estate and asset protection planning. And in particular, we form many, many LLCs as they, in our opinion, are the most flexible and have the most benefit. The benefits of the LLC, number one, right out of the gate, are the high level of asset protection that it enjoys. Again, assuming it's properly formed under jurisdictions such as Nevada or Wyoming and Delaware, and then properly maintained. In addition, the LLC enjoys a valuation compression on the assets in it, centralization of management, gift and estate tax planning for family assets, just to name a few. But up until January 1st of 2018, the LLC and other pass-through entities were considered income tax neutral, meaning there wasn't really any upside or downside to the owners of these entities from an income tax perspective. All the income generated by the entity passed through it and was reported on the individual owner's income tax returns or 1040s. However, after this new legislation was passed, there is now up to a 20% deduction of the income passing through the entity to the owners, thus significantly reducing the owner's income tax liability and money paid to the IRS. So no longer are these LLCs and other entities just income tax neutral. Now they should be considered income tax beneficial. However, like anything good, the full 20% deduction is not available to everybody under the sun. There are some specific income requirements and specific rules relating to the type of business that the entity is performing, specifically the service businesses, which are medical practices, financial service firms, consulting firms, accounting, and unfortunately law firms. But with that said, most LLC owners will qualify for some deduction, and many will enjoy the full 20% deduction. So again, my goal today was not to make anybody expert in this new tax law, but rather just to highlight this particular deduction, as it is extremely generous, and many of the Anderson Firm clients already have established one or more LLCs as part of their estate and asset protection planning. And for those who haven't taken advantage of the LLC and made it part of their planning for whatever reason, might want to go back and reconsider and take another look at the entity to see all the benefits that it has to offer. Keeping asset and liability lists, bank account information, planning for distributions out to the members, all those sorts of formalities and documentation, record keeping will go towards keeping this a healthy entity separate and apart from its actual owners, and thereby buffering that asset protection. So the LLCs are wonderful entities, offer lots of benefits. They're a little complex to set up, but that's our job. But then there is some maintenance that needs to be done to keep them in good standing. And again, that's certainly something that we can help with, but also the LLC owners need to participate and be aware of it. So again, thank you for letting me have a moment of your time, and please feel free to ask any other questions after the call. Okay, now that we've talked about the potential income tax benefits available for our LLCs, let's discuss maintaining the asset protection benefits of our LLCs. So, as we've mentioned previously, not all LLCs are created equal. There are certain states, such as Wyoming, which have a stronger level of creditor protection for its LLC. However, we also have to keep in mind that we need to properly maintain the LLC over its lifetime to ensure that it enjoys this high level of asset protection. So I would just want to briefly go over a few of the maintenance or care and feeding items on the LLC checklist to make sure it stays in good shape for its life. The first item on the list is filing the annual report with the Secretary of State. This needs to be done every year, and it needs to be done in every state that the LLC is registered in. Fortunately, this is a very simple process in most states. Wyoming, again, for example, it is literally three clicks of a mouse and a $52 credit card payment online, and I will have been able to check the box for filing the annual report for that state for that year. The second item on the list is a big picture item, but it's also a big ticket item, and that is keeping the LLC assets and liabilities separate from personal asset and liabilities. And this is very important because one of the main sources of asset protection for LLCs is this concept that it is a legal entity separate and distinct from its owners. This is a line that can become blurred at times, especially when we're dealing with family assets held in a close LLC or single member LLCs. However, we need to be diligent on this because any good plaintiff's attorney is going to try to merge the entity and the individual together. They want to be able to claim that this is one and the same. I call this the personal piggy bank argument. If the plaintiff's attorney can evidence the entity and the individual being one and the same, they're able to apply judgments gained against one to the other. So it's almost like a two-for-one. If there's a judgment against the individual, they will want it to stick to the entity, or vice versa. If the judgment is against the entity and they want to reverse, veil, pierce, and attach personal assets. And the way that these plaintiff's attorneys will make this argument, or one way anyways, would be to show bank account statements of the LLC where it was paying personal expenses of its owners, things that a business wouldn't normally pay for its owners. Things such as a kid's college tuition, a personal dry cleaning, family vacation, those sorts of items. And so again, they'll try to merge the entity and the individual together and make that personal piggy bank argument. This can be nullified on the defense side if the LLC would have simply distributed the money out to the owner and then they spent it on whatever they want, the kids' college tuition or the family vacation. that extra step of the transfer from the LLC to the individual, and then the individual spending it on the items that they wish to, would have nullified the plaintiff's argument of personal use and personal expenses. So that leads us to number three, and number three on the maintenance list is keeping good records. Again, we want our LLCs to be kept separate from us, and we want to limit our liability. And keeping good business records and following the legal formalities with the LLC will go a long way to do that. So things like keeping a membership roll of the LLC's owners, keeping asset and liability lists, bank account information, planning for distributions out to the members, all those sorts of formalities and documentation, record keeping will go towards keeping this a healthy entity separate and apart from its actual owners, and thereby buffering that asset protection. So the LLCs are wonderful entities, offer lots of benefits. They're a little complex to set up, but that's our job. But then there is some maintenance that needs to be done to keep them in good standing. And again, that's certainly something that we can help with, but also the LLC owners need to participate and be aware of it. So again, thank you for letting me have a moment of your time, and please feel free to ask any other questions after the call.
Thank you, Aaron. Our next speaker is Christian Lazouk. Christian is the firm's drafting and funding director and is going to review the formalities required to maintain the asset protection of your LLC and explain how the Anderson firm can assist you in keeping your LLC up to date. Christian?
I wanted to take a few minutes to talk about asset protection of LLCs. In order for an LLC to maintain its asset protection status, certain formalities must be followed. For instance, the LLC must file annual reports with the Secretary of State. The LLC must do quarterly meeting minutes, and these minutes essentially memorialize the actions of that LLC for that quarter. Also important is ensuring that the LLC bank account is not commingled with your personal assets. So you want to separate your personal assets from your business asset. So you don't want to use your LLC bank card for the nail salon. So those are the basic formalities of maintaining asset protection. Throughout the years, we've had many complaints from our clients that they just can't keep up with the quarterly meeting minutes and that they can't keep up with the annual report filing. So we launched last year our LLC program. We do all that for you. We can file your company's annual reports, and we also can do the quarterly meeting minutes for your LLC. And finally, just a little public services announcement. We are aware of some scams where companies are sending these notices to our clients that have recently filed their LLC. These notices appear to be from some sort of government agency, and it's basically intended to scare you into believing you have to pay for a certificate of status or purchase a labor law poster. These are just scams, and the certificate of status and labor law poster are free. But if you're in doubt, give me a call, email me the document, and we'll look it over for you. That concludes what I have for asset protection of LLCs. And now I'll pass this over to Will Anderson, and he'll be speaking about estate settlement and probate. Will?
Good morning, everyone. I want to take a second to discuss estate settlement and probate, which we know colloquially as post-mortem administration. What happens after you go to sit on your cloud? And for most of you, you know this. You know that that if we have a will or we have nothing, then we are going to go through something called probate. It's a court proceeding, and it is time-consuming. You're generally looking at more than a year. We're in year three of one right now. And as we all know, when lawyers get involved in time-consuming court proceedings, it comes with bills. It becomes very expensive. And that's one of the things that we try to avoid with the foundational estate planning. Now, if you're one of our clients, then you, 99% of you, have a foundational estate plan, the revocable living trust-based plan. Now, this plan is the one that we use to avoid probate. Now, again, this is probably a refresher for most people, but the one thing that we need to all make sure is that we are getting the good out of the planning that we've done. And that means making sure that we have retitled the assets. The most common reasons that we have issues with these plans is that people don't do the funding. And remember, funding is just the term that we use for retitling the assets. That's how we get them into the trust. But we found that if it doesn't happen in the first 60 days, it generally doesn't happen. So I implore all of you, go back and make sure that your checking accounts, your investment accounts, your properties, that everything we have at the end of the day is owned by one of your trusts. For most of you, that's just going to be your revocable living trust. If you have more trust than that, then you either know where things need to go based on the asset detail report, or feel free to schedule a call and we can go over everything with you and make sure that everything is where it needs to be. Now, some of these things are obvious, the things I mentioned, your checking accounts, your savings account. But one of the places that we often get tripped up, just because it's not something that we have to consider on a regular basis, is how is the ownership of your business titled? We have clients that may have partners. They may have a business organization that they didn't think about or they don't actively participate in, and they don't generally consider that an asset of theirs. We need to make sure that those are retitled too, even if it's a 1% business interest. That 1%, we need to make sure gets transferred over into your revocable living trust. Otherwise, we very well may have a probate on that one asset when you've retitled absolutely everything else perfectly. And of course, everything else will pass directly, as you said, under the terms of the revocable living trust, but we want to make sure that everything's taken care of. I hate having to open a probate for something small. Now, all of that being said, even if none of the funding gets done, yes, things will eventually get to where they should be in the trust. But we don't want to have a probate to get them there. I'll end up with just one example that shows the dichotomy between the two situations. One of the least enjoyable aspects of this job is that sometimes we need to help people at the last minute. And we did a deathbed plan for a woman several years ago who unfortunately passed away the day after we signed documents. Now, the financial advisor was extremely good and was able to get the account retitled into the name of the trust by the time she passed the next day. Luckily, because he was able to do that, the beneficiaries had access to the funds the next week. Now, that's only for the assets that were in the trust, so the assets that were in the investment account. For everything else, we had a probate. There was just no time to change the ownership. For those assets, we did have a probate, and that probate is still open today, 3 years later. We were able to get access to a safe deposit box, and we were able to get access to some checking accounts earlier this year, and we are hopefully going to be wrapping up soon. So I like this example because it shows with the same estate from the same person the difference in how the assets are passed. The difference is within a week and within years. So I implore all of you, go and take a look. Make sure that everything has been retitled. If it's not, let's have a chat. If you're just not sure, let's have a chat. And with that, I am going to throw it over to Jolene, who is going to talk to us about the SECURE Act and how it affects the IRA should it pass. Jolene?
Thanks, Will. So the SECURE Act has been a pretty hot topic this year. It stands for Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement Act. And it's a bill that was created to make retirement accounts more accessible for everyone. As we've seen over the past several decades, fewer and fewer employers are offering pensions, and this used to be one of the main sources of retirement income. In addition, the costs of having a 401k plan were excessive for small businesses, so many didn't offer one. We're seeing fewer people take the initiative to set up their own IRAs. And because of all these factors, we're seeing fewer people that have adequately planned for their retirement. So the purpose of this bill was to help overcome those hurdles and issues. There is a split of opinion as to whether or not this act would accomplish that, but I guess we'll see once we get, or if we get, a final version of this. There are some really well-received provisions in the SECURE Act, which is probably why the bill passed the House 417-3 on May 23rd. However, there are a few really contentious provisions, which is probably why it's currently stalled in the Senate. Some of the popular provisions include things like allowing employers to offer annuities inside of a 401k with limited liability, which would guarantee an employee a lifetime income option. Another new change would require employers to include long-term, part-time employees in their plans, as long as the employee has completed at least 500 hours of service each year for 3 consecutive years. For those small businesses that found it cost prohibitive to offer 401ks, this act allows multiple small employers to join together in an open multiple employer plan, or an MEP, which would greatly reduce the cost and administrative burden for each employer. The businesses wouldn't have to share a geographic area or be in a common industry or any of the other requirements that are typically faced under the current rules. The act will allow individuals to dip into their 529 plans and withdraw up to $10,000 to repay student loans. It would allow a person to withdraw up to $5,000 from a retirement plan within a year of the birth or adoption of a child without incurring any penalties. This act would allow retirees to delay taking RMDs until age 72 instead of the current 70 and a half. It also allows a participant that's still working for an employer to delay taking those RMDs, or required minimum distributions, from the 401k until April 1st of the year after the employee retires, regardless of their age. So those are some of the positive and popular provisions. However, as I mentioned, there are a couple of contentious provisions in there. One was a provision that was in the original bill that allowed 529 plans to be used for homeschooling expenses. This provision was removed from the final bill and has some people upset. But the biggest issue with this bill, and most likely what has it stalled in the Senate, is the change to the stretch rules regarding retirement plans. Under the current rules, when you pass away, the beneficiaries of your IRA are able to stretch that IRA out over their life expectancies and enjoy the tax-deferred growth of that IRA. The act would limit the stretch to a maximum of 10 years, with a few exceptions for spouses, minor beneficiaries, or disabled beneficiaries. Of course, the purpose of this is to pay for the expense of the majority of the other provisions in this bill by accelerating the income tax due on those inherited IRAs. This is predicted to generate approximately $2.5 billion by 2029. As the Senate is considering this, they're coming up with their own variation of the bill called the Retirement Enhancement Securities Act. And they'll have different tweaks to the above provisions and some new ones. So just as we saw with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, this could be in a very different form if and when it passes. Of course, attorneys, CPAs, wealth advisors, and other planners are already brainstorming on workarounds for IRA planning if this act should pass and have those limitations in it. And we've come up with some really great ones. So I don't want any of you to lose any sleep at night over this just yet. We'll all stay tuned to see what happens and where things go with this and where we need to go moving forward. And now I'll turn things back over to Sean Shepard to discuss a topic that is becoming more and more important with the changing times: what to do when your kids are no longer dependents.
This is actually Will, but thank you. I'll take that compliment any day. Now, for most people on this call, you already have a revocable living trust in place. And I know that a lot of our clients also have children. And one question that we get a lot of is, at what point do the kids need to do their own planning? And the answer is when the kids turn 18. The kids oftentimes don't realize that mom and dad aren't legally entitled to make certain decisions for them anymore, even though they've always made those decisions in the past, like financial decisions or healthcare decisions. Sometimes this works out for them. Have you ever tried to call your child's school and get a copy of their grades? The schools generally won't give them out. But there are also times where this does not work in the child's favor. If the child's in a car accident and someone needs to make medical decisions right now, who makes those decisions? Who has the right to? What paperwork are we going to need to do? And the same thing is true of the financial decisions. If that child can't make them, then who's making those decisions for them? Who's going to handle the finances and make sure that the bills get paid? Now, for these new adults, we recommend a basic set of documents that includes all necessary health care and HIPAA directives, financial powers of attorney, and a simple trust that includes a disability panel, just like the one you have in your trust that helps you determine who gets to declare you disabled. And we always have that primary care physician or that doctor in there. We don't want anyone getting mad and declaring anyone else disabled. Now, this set of documents will take care of most any situation, and it ensures that things will be dealt with quickly, efficiently, and most importantly, it makes sure that you won't be inadvertently left out of the important decisions. So if you think that this is something that resonates with you, if it's something that you think your child or someone else you know might need, please give us a call and let's talk about it.
So as we all know, the law is not a static beast. It changes every year and it changes over time, just like estate planning, which changes with your life as things and time goes on. So there's a couple of things that I want to chat about that may affect your or somebody you know's estate planning. First, I want to talk about New York LLCs and specifically single member New York LLC. Now that just means that there's one owner of the LLC. It's not split between two people or three people. It's just one person. Now, we do a lot of these to protect investment accounts and the like, but in New York, there is an extra layer of liability that we need to consider. There has been case law handed down that has forced owners of single member LLCs in New York to liquidate their interest to pay a creditor. Now, to me, say, where is the LL in my LLC? There's no limited liability there. If that's an option, why did I even do it in the first place? So it's very important that if you or someone else has a single member LLC and you're doing it for asset protection purposes, that you understand that there is a chance that a court could force you to dissolve that interest to pay a creditor. Now, what do we do about this? Well, for many of you, you know that we have Wyoming LLCs that are a much better protection against creditors. Now, why is this? Well, it's Wyoming, first and foremost. Any stream of revenue that they can get, they will hold on to, and they are now and historically have been very business friendly. Your piece of trivia for today is that Wyoming created the first LLC. So they have always been on the forefront of limited liability companies. But in New York, we have a law that says that you can choose the law under which your business is managed. Because we allow people to use New York law, it's only fair that we let our own people choose other states' laws to govern their LLCs and the like. In Wyoming, a creditor's sole remedy is a charging order against any distributions you take. They cannot force you to dissolve your interest as long as you are following the formalities that Sean laid out earlier. So what does all of this mean? It means that if we have a New York LLC and it's a single member, and we're doing it for asset protection purposes, we seriously need to consider looking at other states. It's not a difficult conversion to go from one state to another. Heck, we can have a Wyoming LLC own your current LLC interest. But either way, if we're doing it for asset protection, we want that extra layer of protection, getting it out of New York law. Second, I want to talk to the New Jersey clients and to anyone that has any family or friends in New Jersey that this may affect. Now, first, and this is a big one, if you know any couples that are unmarried, people that may have said, you know, we've been together for this many years and we have always been fine without being married, why would we change things now? Well, there's one very good reason. Yes, New Jersey did repeal its estate tax, but what a lot of people don't realize is that the inheritance tax is absolutely still on the books. In simple words, what this means is, as long as you're leaving it to somebody that you are related to, a wife, a child, a direct family member, then you're probably not going to owe any inheritance tax. But the one place where many, many people get tripped up
is unmarried couples. If you're married, then you are considered a Class A beneficiary. That's the husband, the wife, the kids. However, if you are simply living together in the state of New Jersey, you are looked at as a Class D beneficiary, and it is exactly as it sounds. It means that you are going to owe a tax. Well, your partner or whoever you are leaving the assets to, they very well may owe an inheritance tax. So my easy practice tip is we can either give the money to the state of New Jersey or we can give it to your significant other. All we have to do is go to the courthouse, get the piece of paper, get married. This is the easiest practice tip you can find. Finally, for our New Jersey clients, and this one's not a big one, but there has been some adverse case law that's come down in the last year, which I can't imagine is going to stay on the books for very long. But as of current, they have recently admitted an unsigned will to probate. Now, for many reasons, we can't imagine that this will stick around, but it is something that everyone in New Jersey needs to be conscious of. And if you have old copies of documents, old unsigned versions of your documents, please shred them, throw them away. The last thing we want to have happen is for an old copy of your documents to be found and accidentally used. So with that, I am going to turn it back over to Angela Hooper, and she's going to talk about our areas of practice and the importance of keeping your estate plan up to date. Angela?
Thank you, Will. We are almost done with today's presentation, but I want to address something we do not want to hear, and that is to hear you say, "I didn't know your firm could do that." So let's review the Anderson firm's practice areas. Number one, and likely the area of law we are most known for, is estate planning. But what is estate planning? Whether your estate is very small or if you are a billion-dollar lottery winner, every client needs estate planning. We realize each client is different and requires specialized attention to reach their needs and goals. And for most people, their goal is to maintain control of what I own while I'm alive and well, take care of me and my loved ones if I'm disabled, when I'm gone, be sure what I have goes to the people I want, when I want, and in the way I want it to, and accomplish all this with the least amount of stress and in a way that will keep my family together and not cause division. Estate planning starts with the foundational plan. An estate plan that works will include the revocable living trust, a pour-over will, durable power of attorney, living will, healthcare surrogate or healthcare power of attorney, a quitclaim bill of sale, and a funding plan or asset detail report. And remember, funding a trust is just as important as creating the trust. In the estate planning process, we cover retirement planning. That deals with your personal retirement plans like your IRAs and 401ks. We also address tax planning. Depending on your specific situation, tax planning techniques can be employed to reduce income tax, gift tax, inheritance tax, and estate taxes. We have over 60 different estate planning techniques that can zero out estate taxes no matter how large the estate. And we look at advance planning. Think of advance planning as an a la carte approach to solving a client's specific objectives or challenges. Some of the tools we use in advance planning are irrevocable life insurance trusts, spousal gifting trusts, legacy trusts, special needs trusts, and many others. Another area of practice is estate settlement and probate. Today, Will talked about settlement and probate, but what we didn't discuss is that our skilled attorneys and highly experienced settlement and probate staff are here to walk your loved ones through this difficult process and provide a complete overview of the estate, the taxes and debts that may be incurred, and identify any portions of the estate that would require probate. Next area of practice is asset protection. For some, putting an asset protection plan in place is advisable, and the goal is to remove the economic incentive to be sued and also try and increase the ability to force an early settlement in the event a suit is filed. We work with each client and their financial advisors and develop an asset protection plan that works to legally secure their assets and minimize taxes and transfer penalties. Another practice area is litigation. Litigation is a very specialized area of law, and that is why it's important to have a law firm that has experience in handling these matters. Our litigation attorneys are not only skilled at handling cases, but draw on a thorough knowledge base of the very specific procedures surrounding these issues. We take each case through to completion, but also realize that full-blown litigation often can be avoided if we work diligently to come to a resolution. The last practice area I'll cover is real estate. We possess the expertise of being able to draft and review any matter of contract relating to real estate, such as purchase and sale contracts, leases with purchase options, stock purchase agreements, joint venture agreements, mergers and acquisitions, and business purchase agreements.
I hope it's safe for me to assume that everyone on this call has an estate plan in place. But in our experience, we found it's highly unusual for a client's life situation to remain the same for more than a few years, and it's critical that your estate planning documents reflect your current life situation. Why? Because in the event of disability or death, your most current documents control not only who receives your property, but who will be responsible for your health care and financial decisions. So what should you look for that might trigger the need for an estate plan update? Family changes like marriage, divorce, illness, or incapacity of anybody in your estate plan, as well as birth, adoption, or death of children and grandchildren. Think about the maturity of your children, the roles they should or should not serve in your estate plan. And look at the current relationship you have with successor trustees or beneficiaries. Who have you named to make healthcare decisions for you if you become disabled? Have you relocated to another state? Do you have any potential liabilities, life insurance needs, or existing policies with a beneficiary other than your trust? What are your charitable intentions? Have there been changes in federal or state law? Do you have a new home or other real property? Has there been any growth in your retirement plan, such as your IRA or 401k? Basically, have there been any significant changes in your financial situation? So take time and review your asset detail report. If there are significant changes, let us know. While reviewing your assets, also make sure the funding of your trust is complete. And if you need help, we've got staff in place who can assist. If any of these events have occurred since you last updated your plan, please contact us. Together, we can determine if an update to your estate plan is necessary. There's one more thing. If your contact information has changed, please let us know so we can update our records. In summary, the Anderson Firm practices in estate planning, estate settlement and probate, asset protection, litigation, and real estate. We are a unique firm. We strive to make sure every client has the ultimate client experience. We hope that if you or your family or friends have needs that fall in these areas, you will reach out or direct them to us for a complimentary consultation. So, what happens next? If you have questions regarding any of today's topics, you heard about a technique that may work for you, or you think you may need a change to your current plan, simply contact us at 866-230-2206. It looks like that's all the time we have for today. If you have a question you would like answered, you may email your question to education@taf.law. Again, thank you for joining us and for allowing the Anderson Firm to serve you.